If you're looking for the perfect gift, you're covered with a gift that's sure to wow. Taste of Chicago ships Lou Malnati's legendary deep dish pizzas nationwide. Plus, they ship other Windy City favorites too. Visit tasteofchicago.com to order today.
Tonight, we'll celebrate the 99th birthday of entertainment icon Dick Van Dyke. Plus, Joey Deoria, WGN-TV's Bozo, the legacy of Frasier Thomas, and more. The Dave Player Show is next.
Shut up, Dave.
All right, welcome in, everybody. It's Dave Player here on 720 WGN. We have a big show for you tonight, and the biggest part of it is the celebration of an entertainment icon's 99th birthday today, and that is the legendary Dick Van Dyke. Earlier today, a music video featuring Dick and rock legend Chris Martin from Coldplay was released to honor Mr. Van Dyke and his milestone birthday. Now, the song features visual moments from Dick's 75-year-plus career on radio, television, the stage, and the movie. You can watch it on YouTube, but you can listen to a little bit of it right here. Here's Dick Van Dyke and Chris Martin of Coldplay with All My Love. Well, that's all we really can play, but you have to watch it on YouTube. All My Love with Chris Martin from Coldplay and living legend Dick Van Dyke, who turned 99 today. A beautiful song and an amazing reflection on aging, family, and love. Dick recently became the oldest Emmy winner in history for an appearance on daytime soap opera Days of Our Lives earlier this year, and that's on the top of his 6 Emmys, a Grammy Award, a Tony Award. He's a recipient of the Screen Actors Guild Lifetime Achievement Award, Britannia Award, Lifetime Achievement Award, Kennedy Center Honors in 2021, inducted into the Television Hall of Fame in 95, and was instituted into the Disney Legends Hall of Fame in 1998. First, with a clip from the iconic 1960s sitcom, The Dick Van Dyke Show, here is Dick Van Dyke.
Hi, Dave. Dick Van Dyke.
Oh, Mr. Van Dyke. What an honor this is to have you on the show, I got to tell you. Thank you for taking the time. You're an icon. You're an American icon, for God's sake.
And I'm from Illinois.
And you are from Illinois. I know we'll talk to you a little bit about that. Absolutely.
You'll have to take my advice and not do what I did.
Train,
for God's sake.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what you did, because, you know, this long, amazing life of yours and why you keep moving and continuing to have the time of your life, it's about moving and keeping things forward. You worked in radio first, which I found fascinating. It was like World War II. You were 16 years old when many of the newsmen and disc jockeys on the air were drafted. They needed to recruit new talent. And at 16 years old, you got your first job on the air.
I got the job. I loved it. I have to tell you a story. After the war, must have been 45 or so, I actually got an audition at your station.
That's awesome.
I took the train to Chicago. Checked into just a flea bag hotel I could afford, and left a call. They didn't call me, and I missed the audition. And I got on the train, came home.
Oh man, you could have been here. You could have been here right now. That's awesome.
That's right. It was going to be my big break. I was going to be at WGN, and I missed it all together.
Oh my.
So I became a comedian instead.
So you became a comedian. Well,
isn't that funny?
It is. That's a wild story. And you know, you spend so much time, you said, as a comedian. You know, I know back in Danville you were on stage at the Town Theater, the Red Mask Players.
Mm-hmm.
Performed a lot of those shows. You were in the service and you really honed your skills in special services, entertaining the troops.
That's right. The war was winding. I was training to be a pilot.
Yeah.
I was in pilot training, and the war just wound down. And didn't know what to do with us. And so I started singing and dancing.
In the late 40s, you set your sights on being an announcer on this new medium called television. So that's kind of what you wanted to do. You kind of set your sights for that.
Well, that would be a good career, wouldn't it?
It would.
Television hadn't come along yet. But sounded good to me.
Yeah. You did a stage act for years. You landed a job on a local Atlanta TV station where you thought you'd be that announcer. And instead of giving you the announcing job, they did that, but they also gave you a full hour on the air of live television every day.
That's exactly right. Can you imagine that? No producer, no writer, no nothing.
It was all you.
You just went on and filled the time with whatever you could think of. Yeah, good training, though. Good experience.
I would think so. I would think so. I remember you talked about this before. You pretty much read the paper on the air.
Just about. And there was a book of jokes that everybody, Joe Orson or something like that, put out a kind of a monthly book of jokes for people who did television, commented on current affairs, and things like that. I drew and I lip synced to records, anything I could think of.
And at the same time, you were also a morning radio host. You know, you had a wife and kids. You obviously had to make a living.
Yes.
You know, so you took what you could to make your way, right? I mean, that's what we all do.
Oh, God. Well, you know, when you have your first kid, you panic anyway.
Right.
And I went out and took, like, two extra jobs.
Yeah. No, you do those things. And, you know, and then I know you moved on. You worked in New Orleans. And in 1955, you met with CBS executives in New York, and you got yourself a seven-year contract. That must have been surreal. After all the hard work and all those years paying your dues, you got a seven-year contract.
I did. I had been making $10,000 a year, and this contract started out at $20,000. I thought in those days, I thought I've hit the lotto.
Yeah.
I had to go audition. I had to go do a little song and dance and tell some jokes and things. But it was kind of what's called the button-down area. There was Bob Newhart and Orson Bean. Mm-hmm. But we all kind of looked alike, and I think they thought I was one of those guys, which I wasn't. After, I think I served 3 years of a seven-year contract, and they let me loose. They didn't know what to do with me, and I didn't know what to do with them.
Well, you hosted this CBS morning show. You did this morning show, and Walter Cronkite was your newsman.
I was 29 years old.
Oh,
I had
wow.
no idea what I was doing. They tried me out at that. Walter was just one of the sweetest human beings who ever lived. I have a picture that he said of the two of us on the news set. It said, "How did you ever make it without me?" Walter. He was
awesome.
A wonderful guy. He should have been president.
Oh, that's cool. That's very cool. Now, all this, and you said you played out 3 years of your seven-year contract, and you made your Broadway debut in Girls Against the Boys in 59.
Yeah, we ran for 2 weeks.
2 weeks? Was that it? Was that it? Yeah, but right after that came Bye Bye Birdie. I mean, so that's really what kind of happened for you.
Yeah, somebody was behind the scenes there. Suspicions, you know, a couple of friends who were writers. I think somebody put in a good word because I went up on the stage and danced and said Once in Love with Ava, you know, did a little soft shoe. And Gower Chapman just walked up on the stage and said, "You have the part." And that only happens in Hollywood movies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And to you. I mean, what a lucky life.
But I think somebody had put the word in. I really believe that.
Sheldon Leonard, Carl Reiner saw you perform, and at that time there was a sitcom pilot floating around written by and starring Carl called Head of the Family, which became your show. How did this all come about? Like, they just came backstage, said, "We love you, we want you to try out for this"?
Actually, I don't think I even met them that night. They didn't come back. I heard, Carl sent me about 8 scripts he had written. And I had a little idea of my own, which I threw out the window. I've read some of the best writing I've ever read. I don't know why I think CBS told him, "We like the show, but get a better actor."
That happens. I mean, that happens. You know, you got great ideas, but they want to bring someone else into the role. And you knew, obviously, your show shows in Sid Caesar, so you know how good the writing was going to be with Carl, right?
God, yes. for 5 years, I wouldn't leave the house on Saturday night because of your show of shows.
Sure.
You know, you couldn't tape it back then. You either saw it then or not. I would not leave the house. That was, I think, a real milestone. They changed the face of television comedy with that show.
They did, and it's funny you say that because, you know, with all the reruns that are out there, and, you know, you see the Lucys in your show and so forth, but that's in the Honeymooners, but that's one that doesn't get a lot of play, like from a syndication standpoint, and really was one of the most brilliantly written
shows. There's only 10 shows left.
Oh.
They destroyed them all.
Oh, isn't that something?
I can't, there were 10, and the rest were all, the Kennys were destroyed. It just that's really tragic.
Yeah, it is tragic. It is. And no one could figure out, really, they weren't going to use Head of the Family. They really didn't know what to call the show, and nobody really knew at that point who Dick Van Dyke was, but they settled on that. But they settled on the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Yeah, well, we couldn't think of a name, but Double Trouble and things of that kind. Everything we thought of was pretty corny. So I think that was part of the reason we failed the first season. Nobody knew what a Dick Van Dyke was. That's what Rosemary said when they asked her about doing on the show. She said, "What's a Dick Van Dyke?"
That's great. That's great. Well, speaking of which, you know, Maury Amsterdam, Rosemary were already cast in the show. They weren't in the pilot, but they were cast for the new show. How great. What amazing talents to be able to work with, right?
I've never fallen into such a perfect blend of a performer. We were like an improv group.
Yeah.
God, they were good. It was such fun. Carl could just give it an idea, and we could work it.
Yeah, that's
it was like going to a party, as Maury said. God, it was fun.
I know Mary Tyler Moore was 23 years old at the time when she was in.
Yeah.
When she was auditioning.
I was 12 years older.
Wow.
I said, God, I didn't feel a little young. But the funny thing is, on the 5 years, nobody ever said, "Isn't he a little over her?"
Well, and the chemistry was amazing between the two of you, but at first you weren't sure she could do comedy. I mean, that really wasn't her background, but she really did show everybody she could do it.
I know. Even she didn't know she could do comedy.
Yeah.
She was just, her time. Of course, she had Rosie and Maury and Carl Reiner, a lot of people who knew what they were doing, and it just rubbed off on her.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, the character of Rob Petrie, how much of Rob Petrie was Dick Van Dyke?
Well, quite a bit. Carl always said that they wrote Yiddish, and we played British. a Jewish sense of something. I can't, it's hard to put it. Jewish wisdom, Jewish experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did it American. But I played a guy who, you know, had a lot of child inside. He was intelligent and a nice guy, but he had a childlike fear of authority and not a lot of confidence in himself outside of his own, you know, bailiwick.
Yeah.
And I loved playing that.
Well, I will tell you, I mean, the show, though, stands on its own almost 60 years later. You know, there's not, you know, and I know you know this by watching there's some shows that, because of dated material and so forth, it's hard to watch today. You know it's from another era. That show, the writing, is so amazing that it completely is one of those shows that stands up today.
Carl did that on purpose. He didn't want any jokes of the day, any mention of the news of the day. And even the clothes are starting to look the same again. They're coming back.
Yeah, yeah. It's true. No, it's true. It's totally true. Now, I have to tell you, when the show opens, they pause it in the beginning, and they literally place bets. Is he going to trip? Is he going to skip around? Is he going to almost make it? Which is it going to be? And they should be playing for money.
You know, a lot of people did. A lot of people gambled on that.
Yeah. What a fun way, though, to just get you engaged right at the front of the show.
Yeah, it really was. Of course, Carl hadn't written any physical comedy at all, but he, out of deference to my love for it, he let me do it.
That's awesome. And, you know, you were mentioning earlier, first season, 39 episodes, which 39 episodes in one season is, of course, unheard of today. I mean, now they're doing like 9 episodes.
I know. And, you know, Carl wrote every one of them.
Oh, it's amazing. That is absolutely.
Yeah, he was calling for help by the second season.
I bet he was. I bet it was critical acclaim. Ratings were a little low that first season. The audience discovered the show in summer reruns.
Yes. And our producer, Sheldon Leonard, went down to Cincinnati and talked to Procter & Gamble, who had been the sponsor, and just said, you know, don't throw this one away. Thank God.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And from the writing perspective, you know, Carly, as you said, wrote a lot of it, but he allowed, which is, again, rare today, input in the script. I know Maury wrote a lot of his own stuff, which is pretty unheard of because there's a lot of egos in this business.
Today you have to do every dotted, you know, every tittle.
Yeah.
But we rewrote that. Carl said sitcoms is about rewriting. All we did was rehearse all week and rewrite. Everybody came up with things, and oh my God, we polished it another probably 20% by the show. And so I did a guest shot not too long ago. 12 hours of shooting, 30-second shots from here and from there. The timing is actually the editor's job. The performer has no way. We did it in front of an audience where it was like a live performance, and you did your own timing. And I think that's part of what's wrong with them today, the fact that they use canned laughter.
Now, highlight episodes, you know, that everyone always talks about. I mean, you know, the one that's always mentioned is Coast to Coast, where Laura outs Alan and his hairpiece. You know, it's all...
Wasn't that brilliant?
All of them were brilliant. I can't think of one that was like... I've seen them all so many times, and it was groundbreaking. You know, race was obviously a big issue in the 60s, and your show always addressed it with grace.
Yes. Carl was sensational at that. You know, sometimes we got flack from the network. This is back in the early 60s.
Yeah.
And he'd have to fight them sometimes when we were doing anything about race relationships. But we got in the habit of writing in a red herring, something really offensive, and we would fight them tooth and nail over that.
Wow.
And let the real script slip through.
Well, That's My Boy, which was a hysterical one. It was when Rob recounts why he believed Laura and him brought home the wrong baby, and then the door opens up to the couple.
In all my years, that's the longest laugh I have ever heard. We had to cut the cameras and just they laugh for I don't know how many minutes.
Yeah.
And everybody said, you know, the audience will be offended by this. I've never heard such laughter. And that, today it's a classic.
Well, it was done with respect. It was done with grace. I mean, it was done the right way.
Yes, true. Yeah, you know, Carl had one thing. He had good taste.
He did. He did. And, you know, this is the other thing that I always find fascinating. From sexuality point of this, Rob and Laura were always very flirty together, but they always slept in separate beds. And my kids always ask, like, don't they have a son? Like, why is the nightstand in the middle of it? I don't understand that. You know, but that's what you had to do back in the day.
Well, I really got pissed off at Bob Newhart because he and his wife got to sleep in a double.
And I
would say, why is it that you get
exactly
the network wouldn't let us?
Yeah, that is bizarre. Now, my kids, like, as much as it is watching like a Charlie Brown Halloween, the Great Pumpkin Charlie Brown, they always want to watch A Ghost of a Chance.
Oh, yeah. That worked out so great. We were having trouble thinking, is this going to work? It's kind of spooky and funny at the same time.
It was brilliant. It was kind of spoofing the candid camera of the day, you know, also all the great radio mysteries and horror on the air that they used to play. And it was brilliant. It was funny, and it was a little freaky at times, too.
We had so much fun doing that one.
Yeah. See, that becomes a tradition. The Christmas episode, The Alan Brady Show Presents, really a classic unto itself.
Oh, Mary and I got to sing. My favorite, of course, is The Walnuts, which we had such fun.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That was like a Twilight Zone kind of little episode there.
Yeah. But those are fun to do.
But here we have five incredible seasons, 158 episodes. And I heard you knew all along that you were going to go five seasons, and you knew the whole time that was it.
Carl said at the outset, you know, so many shows have gone twice that long, but he felt that you kind of became repetitive, you know, and kind of caricatures of yourself. But look at Seinfeld went for, 11?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he wanted to go on to other things, and also, you know, get tired of he was still carrying an awful lot of the load. Even though we had very talented guys, he would hire new writers and train them and just say, it doesn't matter how ridiculous it gets, if it's credible, if it could possibly happen.
Sure.
And everybody always stuck to that credibility.
Now, Maury, and I know this because I've seen you perform with the Fantastics, your a cappella group, which we'll talk about in a little bit. He wrote lyrics to the show that were never published.
Never published. It's so sad. So we're spreading the word now. We sing them.
I know you do. You got. I'm going to ask you. Do you got a little bit of that for us?
Well, don't worry about the voice. I just do the word.
Okay.
Okay. So you think that you got trouble? Well, trouble's a bubble. So tell all Mr. Trouble to get lost. Why not hold your head up high and stop crying, start trying, and don't forget to keep your fingers crossed. When you find the joy of living is loving and giving, you'll be there when the winning dice are tossed. A smile is just a frown that's turned upside down. So smile on that frown or defrost. And don't forget to keep your fingers crossed.
Ba-da-da.
And then I fall off.
That's fantastic.
The sweetest lyrics. He never even mentioned it to anybody.
That was fantastic, Dick. That was fantastic. Well, I will tell you, from a television perspective, there was also the new Dick Van Dyke Show with Hope Lang, variety show Van Dyke and Company, a stint on the Carol Burnett Show, 178 episodes of Diagnosis Murder. But there was a whole other world for Dick, and that was in the two of the most classic movies of all time. And we'll talk to him about that next on 720 WGN. It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. We're talking to show business legend Dick Van Dyke. Dick, I know Walt Disney called you personally about the part of Bert in Mary Poppins.
He did. I thought it was because I, had been singing and dancing. He had simply heard a quote of mine about the dearth of decent family entertainment. So knowing I could sing and dance, he said, well, that's the guy I want. And that day, when I went in, and the Sherman Brothers played that score for me, and they showed, of course, he had all the scenes in watercolor all over the walls of his office. I walked out of there on the air. God, I just knew it was going to be a great movie.
But, I mean, it was Walt Disney himself reached out to you personally and said, come on down. And they were playing, like they were selling you almost on the part.
We became very good friends. Kind of we were on the opposite sides of the political fence, but still, he was a big kid. He was really a child inside, an old shoe of a kind of a guy. We just talked and talked and talked together.
Now, I know there was an amazing amount of singing and dancing, the Cockney accent. Did you have a lot of time to prepare at that time in the movies, or did you really just go into rehearsal and then hit it?
No, we had lots of time on the dance numbers. The rooftops, I think. They built the stage out of plywood out in the back lot. And we spent about 6 weeks on that. I spent one evening on the accent. They hired an Irishman as a coach, Pat O'Malley, who was no better than I.
To teach you the Cockney accent.
Last summer there was a tweet with Judi Dench and Jeremy Irons and a bunch of great British actors. They were asked, who did the worst British accent in the history of movies? I won, hands down.
Congratulations.
So I said, I wrote it back and said, it's great to be number one.
It is great to be number one.
Yeah, they were so cute about it.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. I know Walt worked very hard to get Mary Poppins to the screen, but I mean, he was trying in the 1930s, and he finally succeeded.
I know. Did you see the movie?
Oh, yeah. Saving Mr. Banks? Yeah.
Yeah, I knew that woman was a curmudgeon, but I didn't know she was that bad.
Yeah, yeah.
He really was tough.
And wanted full control, but you know, when it's your work, I guess you want to see it to come to fruition the way you want to see it, you know?
Well, of course. I know partly how she felt. Mary Poppins in the book was kind of a dumpy little lady. She wasn't a beautiful like Julie.
Yeah.
And she didn't like me. She didn't like the animation. It was amazing. I had heard, stories, but until I saw the movie, I didn't know the problem he had.
Well, here's the cool thing. You filled Mary Poppins within the first few years of the Dick Van Dyke Show. Not bad going from one set with the lovely Mary Tyler Moore to going to another one with the very lovely Julie Andrews. You had it made, man.
Did I luck out with leading ladies?
You did.
And we did it during a hiatus from the Van Dyke Show.
That's amazing.
It took about 3 months, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, in the 60s, if you weren't doing television, you were doing a movie. I mean, you were nonstop.
I never had a vacation for 10 years.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it, but actors have to strike while the sun shines.
It's true, no.
One great thing after another happened for me. All of it so much of a surprise and so unexpected that I look back and say, how did that happen?
Right. Well, your talent speaks for itself. I mean, I know Mary Poppins, it won an Academy Award for the Best Original Song, which isn't supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. It was Chim Chimmery. And
yeah.
You and Julie won a Grammy for that song.
Yes, we did.
How cool is that?
Well, you know, they didn't tell us at the time. It was the funniest story. I got a call from them. They were having a reunion of Grammy winners. I said, I never got a Grammy. And they said, they looked in, and it had been, I think, about 12 years. Oh. They had never given us the Grammy. They had never notified us of the Grammy. And I said, I'll come to the party if you'll give me my Grammy.
Is that right? That was not a category they announced publicly at the time, or what? Was
not that we knew of. Julie didn't know anything about it either.
Oh, that's bizarre.
Isn't that weird?
That is very bizarre. Well, and all this, you know, all this dancing and everything. You know, you've cited your influences as the actors that have embraced physical comedy, especially from the silent era. You've talked about Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, and specifically Stan Laurel of Laurel and Hardy. He was kind of a mentor, and you met him later in his life.
Yeah, I've made it a point. Yeah, I found Stan Laurel. We became good friends. Then I found Buster Keaton out in the San Fernando Valley. And, oh, my God, you know, they were my idols. Mm-hmm. And I did the eulogy at both of their funerals.
And the
one I did for Stan has been ended up in a book of the 20 best eulogies of the 20th century.
Oh, I bet.
So it was heartfelt. I thought they... Well, now when a young comedian comes up to me, I kind of understand, because I was just blown away by meeting Stan Laurel. So I kind of have the idea, they know, they meet an old-timer, how they feel. You're impressed.
Absolutely. Well, absolutely. I mean, you've inspired so many. And I know I've seen people that have talked about just watching you perform over the years in so many different ways. The singing, the dancing, the comedy, the timing. That's what makes you an icon, my friend.
Yeah, we fostered a lot of comedy writers who became writers because it looked like fun.
Yeah, I bet it did. I bet it did.
And some of them say, you know something, it's not all that much fun.
Well, there's a lot of pressure. It's still work, but it's
right.
but you know, it was still a lot of fun. Then came Chitty Chitty Bang Bang in 1968, which another American classic. I remember as a kid, that would air every Thanksgiving night, and we would look forward after dinner to go watch Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
How much fun
was that?
Yeah, it was. It took over a year to shoot. But we traveled all over Europe and England and everything. You know, it was not well accepted by the critics, but the kids liked it.
Yeah, the kids liked it. And that car just—I can't remember where—it just auctioned off about a year ago. I thought it was close to like $1 million. What that car auctioned off for?
I could have bought it for $30,000.
Is that right?
But in 67, that was a lot of money.
Yeah, I bet it was. Yeah. I bet it was. Well, this is why generations of fans know you so well, because you pretty much everything you've touched has become an American classic. What is the hardest part about getting older, Dick? I mean, there's some things you have given up, and tennis and some other things, but I mean, you still go work out. You get up at 6 o'clock in the morning typically every day. You got a key to your own gym. They gave you a key, for God's sake, so you can get in there early and work out.
Well, sometimes there before the owners get
awesome.
There.
I
go in, turn on the lights, do my thing, and then close up again.
Yeah.
But there's some other guys that usually show up. I like to have somebody to talk to. But it isn't the exercise. It's the getting there.
Yeah.
You'll talk yourself right out of it.
Yeah.
And I said, if you only do 10 minutes, start getting there, and you'll be amazed how fast you come around. And you need that oxygen and blood going through the brain, too.
Yeah, and a great way to start your day.
Oh, yeah, you come back feeling younger.
Yeah. Now,
and I sing all the time. A lot of my friends, as you get older, you don't speak much, and their voices get very, very weak. That's why I get up in the morning and start singing, "Oh, what a beautiful morning."
That's awesome.
Well,
that's
a beautiful day, I mean.
You know what? I had met you briefly about 10 years ago. You were walking through Palm Springs. I don't know why you were in Palm Springs. You had like a fanny pack, a backpack on, and you were walking down that street. There was a spring in your step that just motivated me. And I said, boy, this guy just, he knows how to live life. He just does.
Isn't that great? Yeah, I think a lot of older guys just throw in the towel.
Yeah.
Before they should.
Any regrets, any things in life you would do over now that you've kind of, you know, learned just a little bit about yourself and life itself?
Well, I would never smoke and I would never drink.
Yeah. Yeah.
Had a battle through both of those things. And for some reason, I turned down a movie with one of my idols, Cary Grant. I must have been busy or drunk. I don't know. But I didn't do the movie. It was one of those light, you know, Doris Day kind of comedies. But God, I just to be able to say I worked with him.
Yeah, yeah. No, I get that. But those are two big things in life that you learn. But the smoking, I mean, you smoked for a long time. But I think, you know, but you keep moving and you keep active. And it's that the dancing and singing and everything else, that breathing that is, you know, helped rebuild your lungs and made you a stronger individual.
I think that is what saved me, the fact that I was always in movement, you know, breathing.
Yeah.
I see the AMA just released a new list of things to do to prevent Alzheimer's, and exercise is number one. Absolutely obligated to make it now.
You absolutely are. Well, I look forward to talking to you on your 100th, my friend.
I'm going to call you.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks, Dick, so much.
Thanks, Dave.
All right, much more ahead on 720 WGN.